The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. And now, from the December 17th, 2025 online edition of the New Yorker, is cognitive dissonance actually a thing? A foundational 1956 study of the concept, focused on a UFO doomsday cult, has been all but debunked by new research. And now, from the December 17th, 2025 online edition of the New Yorker, is cognitive dissonance actually a thing? A foundational 1956 study of the concept, focused on a UFO doomsday cult, has been all but debunked by new research by Shayla Love. An American psychologist at the University of Minnesota read about these rumors in the early 1950s and was puzzled. Festinger didn't think people would voluntarily adopt anxiety-inducing ideas. Instead, he reasoned the rumors could be better described as anxiety-justifying. Some had felt the earth shake and were overwhelmed with fear. Minnesota read about these rumors in the early 1950s and was puzzled. Festinger didn't think people would voluntarily adopt anxiety-inducing ideas. Instead, he reasoned, the rumors could be better described as anxiety-justifying. Some had felt the earth shake and were overwhelmed with fear. When the outcome that they were spared didn't match their emotions, they embraced predictions that affirmed their fright. Festinger was developing the now ubiquitous theory of cognitive dissonance. He argued that, when people encounter contradictions, they experience so much discomfort that they feel an urgent need to reduce it. In response, a person can update his views, or he can misinterpret and even reject whatever information has challenged his beliefs. He might seek out people who agree with him. He might try to persuade those who don't. A man with a conviction is a hard man to change, Festinger later wrote. Tell him you disagree, and he turns away. Show him facts or figures, and he questions your sources. Appeal to logic, and he fails to see your point. Cognitive dissonance helped explain human choices that otherwise seemed irrational, stubborn, and short-sighted. These were, in fact, attempts to reduce psychological distress. In 1954, while Festinger was refining his theory, he stumbled upon a rare opportunity to observe the effects of dissonance. A newspaper reported that a small Chicago-area group, the Seekers, were receiving messages from aliens about an impending flood that would submerge North America. Festinger and two colleagues, plus several assistants, went undercover. In an influential 1956 book, When Prophecy Fails, the trio wrote that the Seekers committed to the prediction so fully that some quit their jobs while emptying their savings accounts. When no flood or aliens arrived, Festinger and his colleagues wrote, the Seekers tried to reduce the dissonance they were experiencing by recommitting to their belief and evangelizing, a seeming attempt to bring others into alignment with their views. Their research resulted in convincing, if not definitive, confirmation of their hypotheses, a reviewer from the American Sociological Review wrote, Cognitive Dissonance. In 1957, Festinger published another book, A Theory of Cognitive Dissonance, which described laboratory studies of people acting to resolve dissonance. It's hard to overstate how influential the theory is today. You almost certainly can't get through an introductory psychology class without hearing about cognitive dissonance. Adam Mostriani, writer of the Psychology Substack Experimental History, told me, the phrase has been invoked to explain why environmentalists eat meat and why some Trump supporters play down the president's connections to Jeffrey Epstein. Last month, on social media, memes making fun of Cynthia Erivo, the lead actress in the Wicked films, for rushing to protect Ariana Grande from a fan spread on social media. The musician SZA said that we'd eventually look back on these posts and experience cognitive dissonance. Lately, though, the foundational case study of the Seekers has been contending with its own kind of dissonance. Until this year, a box of Festinger's documents, communications with colleagues, research notes, transcribed telephone conversations in his archives at the Bentley Historical Library in Ann Arbor, Michigan, remained sealed at the request of his widow, Trudy. When the files were released, a political scientist named Thomas Kelly discovered that the researchers, who were ostensibly neutral observers, actually wielded a profound level of influence over the Seekers. In a recent peer-reviewed paper, Kelly noted that there were at least 5 paid observers in addition to the 3 researchers. At some Seekers meetings, half of those present may have been infiltrators. One research assistant pretended to dream about a flood and receive psychic messages. One of Festinger's co-authors, Henry Reakin, was revered by the group's leaders. When the flood didn't come, Reakin apparently encouraged the Seekers to double down on their beliefs, Kelly told me in November. Here's this canonical study, and it's backwards, Kelly said. This is misleading people about the dynamics of new religions and social psychology. In the years after Festinger co-authored When Prophecy Fails, his stature grew. In a 1959 study, he and a colleague gave Stanford undergraduates excruciatingly boring tasks, moving spools on and off a tray, rotating pegs on a pegboard. Afterward, they were instructed to tell the next participant that the tasks were enjoyable, and in return, they were compensated either $1 or $20. Right after the students delivered this message, they were asked what they actually thought of the task. Oddly enough, those who had been paid $1 rated it as more enjoyable than those who were paid $20. Joel Cooper, a psychologist at Princeton, remembered reading the study when he was an undergraduate. He was so surprised that he missed his subway stop. That was unimaginable to the field of psychology at the time, Cooper said. The prevailing dogma was that people, like Pavlov's dogs, responded based on rewards. In this instance, those who were rewarded more said they liked the task less. Festinger thought that cognitive dissonance theory could explain this result. In his view, those who had been given more money could justify to themselves why they had lied to their fellow participants, because they had been paid. Those who'd received only the measly dollar, in contrast, lacked a good reason to have lied, and thus had more cognitive dissonance to resolve. They did so, Festinger thought, by changing their attitude about the task. In another 1959 study, 2 students of Festinger's, Elliot Aronson and Judson Mills, reported that the more unpleasant it was for a person to join a group, the more they would later say they liked the group. They theorized that group members were justifying the hazing they had tolerated. Cognitive dissonance seemingly provided a tidy account of a wide variety of counterintuitive behavior. The leader of the Seekers was Dorothy Martin, a 54-year-old housewife who dabbled in occult and Scientology circles. In August 1954, she began telling people about a flood that would take place on December 21st. In the fall of that year, Festinger and his colleagues joined the group. Martin initially said that aliens would arrive at 4 p.m. on December 17th to save them. Then the pickup was moved to midnight on the 18th, then again to Christmas Eve. Then the Seekers began claiming that the group's actions had spread so much light that the flood was called off. In the researchers' telling, they also ramped up their proselytizing by reaching out to the press. Kelly, the political scientist, read When Prophecy Fails a couple of years ago out of personal interest. He told me that he was troubled by its simplistic conclusions. His research has shown him that people are messy actors, capable of stubbornness, but also of quickly dropping their beliefs after political regimes fall. In 2023, he perused the Fessenger archive during a trip to Ann Arbor to visit family. He learned about the box that was sealed until this year, and in May, he returned to read its contents. What he found disturbed him. The paper suggested that when the researchers posed as Martin's followers, they made the seekers more convinced of their existing views. Martin saw great significance in the sudden appearance of the newcomers. One of the three co-authors, Stanley Schachter, wrote that a physician in the group was clearly impressed by these people who, at the last moment for no apparent reason, were clearly attracted to the movement. Oy, have we increased conviction? Martin took a liking to Ryken in particular, calling him Brother Henry, and she is said to have told him that he was the favorite son. Ryken wrote that he probably could have taken over the movement. In the crucial moment when the flood did not arrive, Ryken lashed out at Martin, calling her dense. Outside of her house, Charles Laffhead, the physician, confided in Ryken that he had struggled with his own beliefs. Ryken then asked Laffhead to reassure him. As Kelly writes in his paper, Laffhead delivered a dramatic speech about the importance of keeping faith, which Ryken interpreted as confirmation of Fessenger's theory of cognitive dissonance. After that, Ryken claimed that his faith had been restored. Martin, soothed, channeled a psychic message explaining how the flood had been averted. Ryken continued to take advantage of his privileged status in the group. He said he was an earthly verifier who needed to interview each person and report back to the aliens. Henry enjoyed himself to the hilt with additional horse S-word, Schachter wrote. Kelly has also questioned Fessenger, Schachter, and Ryken's claims that the seekers doubled their efforts to spread their message. Before the prophecy failed, Laffhead was already outspoken enough about aliens that he lost a job at the Michigan State University Health Center. He and Martin had both written articles for magazines, and the group had sent a press release to journalists. Martin had also rattled several parent-teacher associations by sharing her views with local children. Other researchers tried to verify the theory behind When Prophecy Fails. In 1962, researchers examined the Church of the True Word, which had foretold a nuclear disaster. Even when the end never came, the group remained intact and did not change its beliefs. Clearly, either the theory is wrong or it is incomplete, the authors wrote. A 1983 study reported that a millenarian Baha'i sect, which also prophesied a nuclear war that never occurred, eventually stopped its activities because its faith was badly shaken. Cognitive dissonance theory faltered again in 2024. In an effort to replicate research from the 80s, a team of psychologists across 39 labs instructed nearly 5,000 college students to write an essay in favor of increasing school tuition, a position they were presumably against. Some were told that they had to take this stance. Others were allowed to make their own decision. Cognitive dissonance theory holds that people in the voluntary group would have been more likely to update their opinions on school costs. They couldn't justify having written dissonance essays on the ground that they'd been forced. But the researchers did not detect any difference. The two groups changed their minds at similar rates. Some who study cognitive dissonance doubted these findings. Stephen Hine, a psychologist at the University of British Columbia, questioned whether all the labs involved in the replication followed the precise protocols required by the study design. Cooper, the Princeton researcher, noted variations between labs. For example, not all the schools charged tuition, so some students wrote about other subjects. They did a terrible job, Cooper said. But when Willem Sliegers, a social psychologist at Tilburg University and a co-author of the study, pointed out that early proponents of the theory used very similar experimental setups to make their case, If cognitive dissonance really influenced behavior, we should have been able to find it, he told me. We didn't, so we should be updating our beliefs. The concept of cognitive dissonance is appealing, in part because it lends a name to a recognizable state. I have felt it. I've seen it in others. And it seems intuitively true that people respond in some way when confronted with it. Kelly, the political scientist, believes that it's a real sensation. But a person's reactions to cognitive dissonance seem more fragmented than the theory accounts for. The idea lacks predictive power, Slieger said. It's still very vague, he told me. Kelly's research showed that Martin walked back her claims in 1955, saying that she had never expected a literal UFO rescue, but she remained involved in occult groups for the rest of her life. He concluded that she neither increased her proselytizing about the flood nor abandoned her supernatural convictions. Can cognitive dissonance really explain how her wide-ranging beliefs evolved? As Festinger himself wrote, it would be unfortunate indeed if the concept of dissonance were used so loosely as to have it encompass everything, thus depriving it of meaning entirely. In studies of cognitive dissonance with open-ended designs, participants seem to relieve their discomfort in a diversity of ways. In a 2024 study, supporters of Donald Trump were asked about allegations that the president had engaged in sexual misconduct and illegal activity. Some rejected the claims as lies. Others said that they didn't care about the president's sex life or that all presidents are involved in unscrupulous activity that we don't hear about. A minority said that they would no longer support him. Perhaps it's true that they were all acting to reduce their cognitive dissonance. But how successful is a theory of human behavior if it can't tell you how people will behave? In mid-November, I called Aronson, the student of Festinger's who'd conducted research on hazing and dissonance. At 93 years old, he is one of the few people who were in Festinger's direct orbit when he was developing his theory. During a seminar in 1957, Aronson was impressed by Festinger's intelligence, his fervor, and his nastiness. Festinger was a demanding teacher. Aronson became his research assistant. Aronson agreed that many strategies can reduce dissonance. How could you know which a person would choose? Their early experiments, he said, were not designed to answer that. You're not asking the question, what pathways would people choose if they had their choice, Aronson told me. You're saying, does cognitive dissonance exist, and are people reducing it? Aronson said that because When Prophecy Fails was an observational study, it did not take place in the controlled setting of a lab, he has long considered it a weak example of cognitive dissonance research. But he insisted that the theory will remain a useful way to understand human behavior. He credited it with teaching us that our actions, even strange and stubborn ones, are more than automatic responses to rewards. Humans are deliberative. They engage in complex cognitive processes even when waiting for UFOs. Even if it turned out that none of those doomsday cults ever tried to proselytize, it would not cause the theory to be debunked, Aronson said. In his view, a large number of laboratory studies back up the theory of cognitive dissonance, so the new revelations about When Prophecy Fails did not change his mind. I asked him how the theory could be falsified, since any choice a person made could be attributed to dissonance. Well, it's hard to disprove anything, he said. By the mid-60s, Festinger had stopped focusing on cognitive dissonance theory. He studied visual perception and eventually anthropology. But there are clues that his intuitions about how people behave remained consistent. In his archives, there's a handwritten note recalling that his father, who grew up in an Orthodox Jewish family in Warsaw, wandered into the city to eat ham at the age of 15. He wanted to know if God would punish him for eating food that wasn't kosher. According to the story, Festinger wrote, "When nothing happened to him, he became a confirmed atheist." But the story left Festinger with doubts. It would not make sense to subject yourself to God's wrath if you were not already sure of the outcome. A more reasonable explanation, Festinger thought, was that his father must have reduced his cognitive dissonance before eating the ham by losing his belief in God. I imagine that, on other grounds, he had already rejected religion and the way of life it implied, Festinger wrote. I asked Aronson if Festinger seemed to view people as rational deep down, seeking coherence in what looked like chaos. I think he thought people were capable of rational behavior and used rational behavior a good deal of the time, Aronson said. But underneath that is the fact that we are rationalizing human beings. Next, from the January 12, 2026 issue of the New Yorker magazine, "Leave Their Kids Behind. Can undocumented parents elude ICE capture for one more year until their youngest turns 18? By Jordan Salama. Lily Garcia was ready for her 17th birthday party well before it started. On a late summer afternoon in San Bernardino, California, the high school senior stood in the cool shade of her family's covered back patio, wearing a black tank top and a high-waisted jeans. As always, her mother, Rosalinda, had gone all out with the preparations. Traditional multicolored Mexican fabrics were draped across tables and benches. Two men from a party rentals company were testing the controls for a mechanical bull they'd set up in the backyard. A mini fridge was stocked with soda, and small bags of Cheetos and Doritos were neatly arranged in a basket. It was 2:30 in the afternoon. Her friends were not even invited until 5. "And that's Mexican time," Lily said, smiling before heading off to her room to double-check her makeup. At the counter of the family's outdoor kitchen, Rosalinda was preparing a huge tub of ceviche, chopping shrimp and cucumbers and limes. It had become a signature dish of hers, and she sometimes sold it to neighbors when the family needed extra cash. Her son, Jose, the oldest of her three children, sat at the head of a long table. "She seems excited," Rosalinda said to Jose in Spanish. "Yeah," Jose replied in English, a bit distracted. The family's names have been changed. The 28-year-old who worked as a scientist at a manufacturing plant in Los Angeles was studying his laptop screen. He was using Google Maps to look at Mazatlan, a city on the Pacific coast of Mexico. "Mom, do you remember the address of the house where you grew up?" he asked, clicking around. "I think it was 414 Emiliano Zapata," Rosalinda said. Jose typed in the address and turned the computer to show her the street view. She shook her head. "That's not it. Try 414 Salvador Allende." That wasn't right either. They went back and forth like this for a while without success. Then they turned to her cloudy memories of people she'd known as a young girl. Because Rosalinda had left Mazatlan when she was barely 7 and was brought to the U.S. by her mother when she was 10, she remembered little about the town. "Do you remember that woman you used to tell us about?" Jose asked. "She had a store." "La Licha," Rosalinda said, sounding excited to be sure about something. "Yes, I'm going to try to figure out where her store's at." While Jose continued searching, Rosalinda said, "I'm going to ask your aunt." She wiped her hands clean and opened FaceTime on her phone. Her sister, several years older than Rosalinda, who was 45, appeared on screen. She was in Mazatlan. Just a few months earlier, Rosalinda's sister had moved back to Mexico after living in the U.S. for several decades without legal status. She had long been wary of President Donald Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric and of his promises to carry out the largest deportation effort in U.S. history. A few weeks after Trump began his second term, she spotted what she thought were ICE agents in the parking lot of their church in Las Vegas. She became so terrified of being arrested that she made the painful decision to leave before the situation got worse. She just didn't want to live with so much fear, Rosalinda told me later. Rosalinda and her husband, Manuel, who are also undocumented, began to consider self-deporting too. They had migrated to the U.S. as children with their parents. Despite having three U.S.-born children of their own, two of them over the age of 21, neither Manuel or Rosalinda had ever been able to adjust their legal status. They had both crossed the border without an inspection, rendering them inadmissible by the U.S. government. The only potential way around this was to file a specific hardship waiver that would rely on Rosalinda's mother, Asuncion, first getting her papers herself. But Asuncion died shortly before her own appointment at a consulate in Mexico, leaving the family with no recourse. The thing is that we were brought here very young ourselves. It wasn't our decision, Rosalinda said. I didn't ask for this. They began looking for a house in Mazatlan. In May, they bought one for roughly $150,000. Meanwhile, the number of ICE sightings and arrests in Southern California continued to climb. Federal agents raided Home Depot parking lots where day laborers waited for work, made traffic stops based on race and appearance, and smashed car windows when individuals refused to open their doors. In cities such as New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, masked armed agents waited to arrest migrants, sometimes violently, as they left immigration hearings. It didn't seem to matter if an individual had a pending asylum case, a U.S.-born dependent, or no criminal record. Once migrants are taken to ICE detention centers, where conditions have been described as inhumane by immigrant advocacy groups, it can be months before they appear in court, all the while they are pressured to sign documents authorizing their own deportation. The Trump administration has also moved to significantly expand third country removals, deporting migrants to places other than their country of origin. In perhaps the most high-profile case of the past year, more than 250 migrants from Venezuela were sent to a prison in El Salvador that is notorious for brutality and torture. Around the same time, Kristi Noem, the Secretary of Homeland Security, released a video that issued a warning to all undocumented immigrants living in the U.S. Leave now. If you don't, we will find you and we will deport you. You will never return. The fear of ICE and of third country removals became so overwhelming that it was all the Garcia family could talk about. They drew the shades in their living room, which faced the street. Rosalinda and Manuel stopped answering the door when they didn't know who was knocking and didn't leave the house except to travel to and from work. Rosalinda managed apartment buildings for a local company. Manuel was a carpenter specializing in the wood frames of buildings. Their older daughter, Anna, who still lived at home, took on virtually all errands requiring driving, including grocery shopping. Neighbors, relatives, and friends without papers were all taking similar precautions. One day in late spring, the Garcia's doorbell camera recorded an ICE arrest taking place across the street. Several dark trucks encircled a man, and agents pinned him to the ground. The Garcias didn't know the man or what happened to him. Around the same time, a letter from the National Visa Center, a division of the State Department which handles petitions for immigrant visas, arrived at their door. It made reference to an application they had filed more than a year earlier. "I already knew that the government has my address," Rosalinda told me. "But in that moment, I realized that sooner or later, they are going to come door to door. Once that letter arrived, I said, I'm leaving." Rosalinda wanted to go immediately, like her sister had, but Jose encouraged his parents to carefully consider their options first. Over the years, the family paid more than $8,000 to various immigration lawyers, most of whom concluded that it would be impossible for them to fix their status without returning to Mexico and waiting out a 10-year reentry ban. Even then, there were no guarantees. It didn't matter that all three of their children had been born in California and were U.S. citizens. One lawyer brought up a crucial point. Lily was still a minor, so if her parents self-deported, she would have to leave with them unless Jose or Anna became her legal guardian. In any case, Lily wanted to finish high school in San Bernardino and figure out her plans for college while her parents were still there to provide support. After a series of dinner table conversations and texts in the family's group chat, it was decided they would wait until Lily turned 18. "The only reason why I haven't left already is Lily," Rosalinda said. "The other two, they're already adults. They have their lives and everything. But Lily is just starting out. She's still," Rosalinda switched to English, "she's still a kid." Lily's 17th birthday party marked a somber milestone. This time next year, barring their arrest and deportation, her parents would leave the U.S., the country where they had grown up, met each other, married, worked, and raised children, all of whom might have to face their adult lives without them nearby. Rosalinda's sister suddenly said, "Ah!" She had remembered the address of the house where they'd lived as small children. It was on Calle Gilberto Ruiz Aldama. Jose pulled up an image of a modest, light-colored home set back from a sidewalk and a paved road. "When I left Mazatlan when I was 7, there was no cement. It was all dirt," Rosalinda marveled. She barely recognized the place. San Bernardino, like much of Southern California, is deeply tied to Mexico and Central America. Long-distance bus companies like Tufesa offer direct service to the Mexican states of Sonora, Sinaloa, and Jalisco. Taquerias and carnicerias proliferate amid the region's massive Amazon and Walmart warehouses, where staffing agencies have long employed low-wage immigrant workers to meet the insatiable demand of the nation's supply chain. Swap meets, flea markets, where vendors hawk everything from secondhand clothing and kitchenware to fresh produce and cleaning products, could be mistaken for the mercados in the central plazas of Tepic or Hermosillo. In recent decades, immigrants from such countries as Vietnam, China, and the Philippines have arrived in San Bernardino, but in far smaller numbers. Many businesses greet customers in Spanish first, as nearly 70% of the city's population is Latino. "Just about everyone I met there had an ICE story, a sighting, a close call, an acquaintance who had been taken. As a result of the collective panic, restaurants saw a steep decline in foot traffic, but also an uptick in delivery orders. When school started up in August, parents with papers offered to pick up and drop off the children of families who were in peril. A 35-year-old Mexican-American school teacher, whose parents are undocumented, told me that after she began going to the supermarket for them, she immediately noticed a pattern. I was taking pictures of different brands and amounts and sizes, texting my mom to ask what exactly she wanted," the woman said. "Then I looked around and realized that all around us there were other young people doing the same thing, shopping for their parents and sending them pictures because they didn't know what to get." Community organizations across the Inland Empire, the metropolitan region east of Los Angeles that includes industrial working-class cities like San Bernardino, raced to implement added security at their facilities and to distribute information about the rights that even undocumented people could exercise when encountering a federal agent. On August 16th, during an immigration check in San Bernardino, agents shattered the window of a man's pickup truck and then opened fire when he drove off. Days later, government forces swarmed the man's home and arrested him. The agents' gunshots could be heard at a nearby nonprofit community center and garden in the city's depressed downtown. The center hosted ceramics classes, handicraft workshops, and celebrations for such holidays as Dia de los Muertos. "All of that is under threat because of the fear of gathering," an employee told me. Staff members there have been trained in how to respond if ICE showed up. The center also established designated safe rooms in the building, with limited entrances and windows where people could hide. As I was shown around, a community leader at the center joked darkly, "These are our Anne Frank rooms." The safe rooms were stocked with cases of water, and there were also folding chairs and bathrooms, allowing people who needed sanctuary to stay for a while. Many organizations holding events popular with immigrants stopped publicizing exact locations, instead sharing addresses only with registered attendees. In July, the bishop of the Diocese of San Bernardino, Alberto Rojas, suspended mass obligations for his parishioners who feared being apprehended by immigration authorities after two arrests on parish property. Such a step is taken only during the most serious of circumstances, such as the height of the COVID pandemic. Many more people started to come up to me after Mass at the parishes saying that they were afraid, Rojas told me. It's a very real fear not to know what's going to happen to your children. And let me be clear, if someone committed a crime, they should go through the system for that crime. I am not encouraging criminals. But this is the Catholic Church. We don't need people to have documents in order to take care of them. We take care of the poor and the vulnerable, no matter what. These are human people. When I arrived in San Bernardino in September, there had been a brief lull in federal activity on the streets. This is how they get us when we start to feel comfortable again, Rosalinda said. Everyone expected enforcement to pick back up. A few days earlier, on September 8th, the U.S. Supreme Court had lifted a federal judge's prohibition against indiscriminate immigration stops in Southern California, based on factors like race, ethnicity, language, and type of work, meaning that someone could legally be questioned simply for speaking Spanish in public, having dark skin, or driving a landscaping truck. Just after dawn on my first morning in town, I drove to an unpaved lot along Highland Avenue, in front of a Home Depot and a Dollar Tree, where day laborers had gathered. Along the south side of the lot, a 25-year-old Salvadoran woman named Lisbeth sold food out of her car. The open trunk of her black Toyota sedan was lined with coolers holding homemade tamales and pupusas, along with salsas and pickled vegetables. A handwritten sign in Spanish listed what else she sold: arroz con leche, agua fresca, soda, Monster, Red Bull. Lisbeth's sister, who was pregnant, sat in the front seat holding a large thermos filled with coffee. "My mother is the one who makes everything. This is her livelihood," Lisbeth explained. The two sisters had legal status, but their mother did not, and she had been staying home ever since ICE repeatedly raided the lot over the summer. Their mother had been present during one raid in August. She was sitting in the passenger seat of the car when agents descended on the site. As the day workers fled in every direction, Lisbeth got into the driver's seat and sped away. "I drove straight home with everything just like this," Lisbeth said, meaning that she'd left the trunk open with a white kitchen trash bag hanging from the bumper. Her mother filmed out the window as they escaped, and Lisbeth posted the footage to her TikTok account in order to warn others in the community. She herself got most of her news about ISIS presence in the area from TikTok. As she recounted the story, a gray pickup pulled up to the curb, its dashboard adorned with Catholic imagery and trinkets from Mexico. Two construction workers were in the front, with fountain sodas in the center cup holders. One of them, whom I'll call Juan, got out to buy tamales for himself and his partner. He was heavyset, wearing a black T-shirt and work jeans. "Would you give me a third tamale so I can feed the pigeons?" he asked. Juan did this many mornings, and Lisbeth obliged, handing over her last tamale, tightly wrapped in aluminum foil. The crinkling sound of foil unwrapping scared the pigeons, which flew to the other side of the dusty lot. "They'll come back," Juan said as he began throwing pieces onto the sidewalk. "Here they come." The pigeons returned, one by one. Juan and Lisbeth got to talking about the raids. A friend of his had been captured over the summer and recently got out on bond. In order to qualify for bond, you cannot have been convicted of certain crimes, and you must convince a judge that you do not pose a threat to the community. "They let him go with an ankle monitor," he said. Moments later, Juan spotted the man, Francisco Javier Garcia Felix, on the other side of the lot, and brought me over to meet him. Felix, a middle-aged man from Guadalajara, with long black hair parted down the middle, clearly had the respect of the other people at the site, whom he called his colleagues. The father of seven children, six sons and one daughter between the ages of 10 and 20, all U.S. born. He was known endearingly as El Apa, a Mexican nickname that means dad. His youngest boys, elementary schoolers who were playing in the back seat of his pickup, He was on his way to drop them off at school. "They're traumatized," Felix told me in Spanish, making sure the children were out of earshot. His arrest took place during a raid on July 6th, just a few steps from where we were standing, as he walked unwittingly out of the Dollar Tree. He had overstayed his visa for 18 years. The next day, his oldest son, Michael, set up a GoFundMe page titled, "Help! ICE Got My Dad." That raised more than $3,000 for the family. During the weeks he was in detention, his family fell behind on their rent and their bills. His daughter did not want to get out of bed. His children submitted letters to a judge as part of his case. "The absence of my father has been devastating towards my everyday life," Anthony, Felix's second oldest child, wrote. "It has impacted so much, like my sleep, mental health, and physical health." Felix's wife, Yessie, managed to hold everything together while navigating the labyrinth legal process to fight for his release. Still, he said, there were days when his children ate only rice and beans. Felix was first sent to a detention center in Los Angeles for a week, before being transferred to an ICE processing facility in the neighboring city of Adelanto. Felix described it as a warehouse with close to 400 detainees in his building alone, and more than 1,000 at the facility in total. Immigrants detained there have complained about cold temperatures and a lack of blankets. In August, CoreCivic, the second largest for-profit prison company in the U.S., reopened a former state prison as an ICE detention center in the nearby Mojave Desert town of California City. With more than 2,500 beds, it is the state's newest and largest immigrant detention facility. On November 12th, seven detainees, represented by the American Civil Liberties Union and other legal aid groups, filed a federal class action lawsuit against ICE and the Department of Homeland Security, alleging dire and inhumane conditions at the California City facility. "Sewage bubbles up from the shower drains," the complaint reads. "People are locked in concrete cells the size of a parking space for hours on end, and officers threaten them with violence and solitary confinement. Food is paltry, and people go hungry. Temperatures are frigid. Those who cannot afford to buy sweatshirts from the exorbitantly priced commissary suffer in the cold, some wearing socks on their arms as makeshift sleeves. Friends and family members who travel to the Mojave Desert to see their loved ones must do so across heavy glass. People detained at California City cannot touch or hug their children. The facility sharply limits access to lawyers, leaving people bewildered and largely incommunicado. By definition, immigrant detention centers like those in Adelanto and California City deal with civil, not criminal, offenders. Living in the U.S. without authorization is a civil offense, not unlike parking illegally. And yet, according to the ACLU, the conditions in such facilities are sometimes even worse than those in prisons. Crossing the border illegally, as opposed to overstaying a legal visa, is a criminal misdemeanor, punishable by a fine, up to 6 months in prison, or both. It rises to the level of a felony only once someone who has already been deported or denied admission, attempts to re-enter the country illegally. After 44 days, with help from a local immigrant rights organization and the Mexican consulate, Felix was released on a $5,000 bond. He told me that he had just been relieved of his ankle monitor. Now immigration authorities were monitoring his phone to ensure, among other things, that he would not attempt to work. Felix spoke warmly of the hundreds of other immigrants he met in detention. There were Arabs, Chinese, Africans, people from every part of the world, he said. Many of the people I met did not deserve to be in there. Many of them didn't do anything wrong, but they're now separated from their families. They were told to sign documents that would authorize their rapid removal without a court hearing. The message was, until you sign, you can't leave. Felix understood that he was the fortunate exception. He made an initial court appearance in November. He now awaits a second court date in January before a judge in Santa Ana. Even so, the situation had shattered his life. This is family destruction, economic destruction, he said. And if they send me back to Mexico, it's practically a forced divorce. undocumented people are being terrorized. Everywhere Felix went, he carried a clear plastic pocket folder containing his Mexican passport and all of his other documentation in case he was stopped again. On a small piece of paper, he had scribbled down an English phrase that his son had taught him, one that captured a strange sadness he'd felt since his release. "Survivor's guilt," he said, reading it aloud before switching back to Spanish. "Like when a plane crashes and you're the only one who lives." When I first met Rosalinda and Manuel, they said that they had mostly withheld from friends the fact that they planned to go back to Mexico. "It's just easier for them to convince themselves to leave if other people aren't begging them to stay," Jose explained at the time. The oldest and most financially stable of the three siblings, Jose would manage most of his parents' assets in the U.S. once they were gone. His sisters had agreed to this. Jose had got married a year earlier at 27, and both he and his wife, also a scientist, had well-paying careers. In order to afford his parents' house in Mazatlan, Jose took out a $200,000 home equity line of credit on the San Bernardino house, which was already in his name because of the difficulties that undocumented Americans face when trying to qualify for mortgages. Once Rosalinda and Manuel were gone, Jose and his wife planned to move in and commute to Los Angeles, about 2 hours each way. They would rent out part of the house to a tenant and send the rental income, roughly $1,200 per month, to Rosalinda and Manuel in Mazatlan. They say that you can live more comfortably in Mexico with $1,000, going out once or twice a week to eat, Rosalinda assured me, though the tone of her voice suggested that she wasn't entirely convinced. Social scientists say that it is common for the children of immigrants, especially the eldest, to take on responsibilities typically handled by adults. "I get a variation of this story every day," Carola Suarez Orozco, a psychologist and a professor in residence at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, told me. She is best known for her research on the psychology of immigration, particularly in children and adolescents. Suarez Orozco said that the concept of parentification in developmental psychology refers to a child taking on some of the roles of a parent in their family system. Often, she noted, children experience parentification in the context of mental illness or substance abuse. "But I noticed many years ago that you would see it in immigrant families, not because of psychological pathology, but because immigrant parents didn't speak the language or because they are working multiple jobs and are not actually present." The children of immigrants often find themselves providing translation help for their parents or helping them navigate complex systems such as healthcare, schools, and legal processes. There is absolutely a tremendous amount of skill sets that these kids and young people develop, Suarez Orozco continued. "There is also an emotional undertow and a price that is paid." She explained that today's anti-immigrant policies project the very real possibility that a parent may disappear at any given moment and also project that you, the child, don't really belong in this society. You'll never really have a place. You're an American citizen, but you don't really belong. Jose admitted that he had not been unscathed. "I started seeing a therapist when all this started happening with my parents," he told me the night of the birthday party. "My therapist said that one of the reasons that I am maybe being very nonchalant about everything is because I have a kind of PTSD. The Garcia family had lived for years with a latent fear of being separated. As Jose grew up, he recognized that certain family habits, rules, and behaviors had been shaped by this fear. Rosalinda offered an example. "We never wanted to turn on the light inside the car when we drove at night because we were worried that the police would see us inside and pull us over," she said. As a result, Jose came to believe that it was illegal to drive with the light on. The realization that his family was fundamentally different because his parents lacked papers became clearer when he entered middle school. He recalled a few instances before he had a cell phone of becoming gripped with fear when his mother went to the store and stayed out longer than expected. His parents decided to give him driving lessons in a parking lot before he was old enough for a learner's permit, in case something happened to them and he had to drive his sisters to a relative's house. In 2010, their home was broken into, but Manuel refused to call the police. Jose realized that he and his sisters all shared a long-standing terror of police officers. The whole family worried about Lily. Jose said that she had responded to the trauma of the past few months by withdrawing. Rosalinda agreed, telling me, "The other day she said, 'Mom, I don't want to hear about your house in Mexico anymore. I don't care.'" When I spoke with Lily alone several days after her birthday party, I asked her what she thought about her parents' decision. "I feel like I'm a deadline," Lily said. "I don't want to hold them back." It bothered her that her parents were risking the terror of detention or a third country removal in order to watch over her for one more year. Lily was the only person who described what her parents were doing as fleeing the country. When the ICE raids began, Lily was in the middle of her junior year, a time when most American high schoolers start to think about whether they will take the SAT, apply to college or vocational training, or enter the workforce. Lily, who always planned ahead, chose to take a psychology elective, which would strengthen her college applications. She hoped to get a graduate degree one day. "I always wanted to do something with the brain, because I realized that childhood really shapes the way that you are, especially at the adolescent age," she said. At one point, I asked her whether she thought her parents were making the right choice. "I think they should go," she said, without hesitation. And then she paused. "But it's not that easy. This is their home." Of course, she meant that it was her home, too. She'd never imagined a future in which she didn't live in the U.S. Lily had grown up after the family had overcome the most difficult financial hardships that they had faced in America. The paths forged by her brother and her sister gave Lily confidence and a clear sense of the opportunities that awaited her if she worked hard. None of her plans involved moving to Mexico with her parents, not even to study, which was initially discussed as a possibility. Lily's life was here. And yet there was a feeling among all three siblings that their country had betrayed them. As a couple, Rosalinda and Manuel had sometimes contemplated returning to Mexico, but only once, more than 15 years ago, did they come close, after a particularly humiliating experience of trying to sign up their young children for Medicaid. Rosalinda told me, "The woman who worked there made me feel so bad that I came back sobbing, and I said, 'I don't want to live in this country anymore.'" But when she and Manuel asked Jose, who was 12 at the time, if he wanted to move to Mexico, he begged them to keep the family in America. "And they respected my wishes," Jose told me, recalling the conversation. "They listened." On weekends, the family liked to unwind at a nearby RV park and private campground where they had been members for years. There were campsites for tents and trailers, rental cabins, barbecue grills, two lakes, and three swimming pools. It had long been Rosalinda's favorite place, and now it had the additional appeal of being private property. "It's all fenced in, so it's one of the few places outdoors where ICE can't just show up," Jose explained. Last spring, when the raids in San Bernardino hit their peak, Rosalinda camped there for 2 weeks. "I slept in a tent close to the showers so that I would be more comfortable," she said. One Saturday afternoon, Rosalinda, Anna, Jose, Irene, and I piled into their black Tahoe and drove to the campground. Jose drove the Tahoe past the warehouses and strip malls of the Inland Empire and turned onto a road that climbed into the San Bernardino National Forest. We arrived at the campground gates, and we all received entry bracelets. Jose parked beside one of the lakes, which is stocked with trout for fishing. Rosalinda suggested that we all take a walk. We reached a quiet, wooded area beside a clear creek. "I want to hug a tree," Jose said, and he wrapped his arms around a large trunk. The rest of us sat out on folding chairs in a patch of grass. The conversation drifted to what they called their America bucket list, trips and experiences they wanted to have together before Rosalinda and Manuel left. A few weeks earlier, Jose had taken his father to a Dodgers game and surprised him with their first ever seats behind home plate. The family planned to drive to Yosemite in a few months. For a while, they had also talked about walking the glass bridge over the Grand Canyon. Then they found out that some Arizona police departments had agreed to share information with ICE. Yet, of all the places in America, it was this peaceful, ordinary campground that loomed largest in Rosalinda's dreams. She had long imagined bringing her future grandchildren here for grandparents' weekends. Now she grew emotional with the awareness that this would likely never happen. We sat in a circle by the creek and watched the sun dip behind the hills. A hawk took up a perch in a nearby tree. Later that evening, on the car ride home, Rosalinda quietly asked Anna, "Do you think that every country has mountains and streams like this?" Anna didn't answer. And Rosalinda turned to me. "The other day, I was telling my children that almost all my life I've lived surrounded by these mountains," she said. "I see them every day. But only now that I'm leaving, I've started to think about how much I'm going to miss them." As usual, I'll end with a poem from the November 24, 2025 issue of The New Yorker, Senescence by D.A. Powell. "Just as I come to know a thing, it's gone again. What's in my heartwood, in my head? Brashy, ashy, friable, crumbled colors, dormancy of matter, of leaf, and orderly degradation. I have come to measure the dark, not just the frost and not the lack of light, the uninterrupted dark, of which the winter is a small part, a contraction of the corona, catch in the windpipe of the old organ, organ of the old windpipe, pipe of the pileated woodpecker pecking a hole in me. Yellow, orange, brown, the greens break down, the chloroplasts depart, each leaf losing its factories from the outside in, its faculties. I seem to mean from edge to artery, the last gold somewhere in a vein of no use now. Abscission is a nice way to say the natural cutting off of things. A wounded limb where leaf scar gives way to bud scale, safeguard, night nurse, attending orderly of the tender leaf below. It comes again, the ascent of spring, first leaf, first bloom, first fiddle of the fiddle fern. I hated to lose the light, right when the frost and the xanthophyll make shatter lightning so plentiful, wind shaking the old boughs timbre style. I do not gentle into any one leaves and another moves in. New twigs, new nest, sometimes a whole new tree in another life, in another fall, from another book and another tongue, and what world? This one, maybe. Maybe the last page torn off, so it can't be read, so it cannot happen, have happened yet. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.